Hi, everybody. I'm Marcia Wallace, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 30th, 1981. My home group is the Living Life One Day at a Time group in Duluth, Georgia. And my sponsor is Maggie Harrison. And for all of those things, I will be eternally grateful. You know what? It doesn't get any better than this. This very day, I just want to tell you, I want to thank the committee for asking me. By the way, Beth, happy birthday wherever you are. Let's give her a... And I want every one of you ladies who had anything to do with this to stand up so I can see you all at one time. I want to see you. Now, come on, stand up and give yourselves a hand. This has been unbelievable already. You have just done a magnificent job, and it's a difficult job, but it is service work at its best, and I am already so filled up. I am reminded of be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. Be still and be. I've already had that feeling already, and if this is just the beginning, imagine what I'm going to be like on Sunday. So I do look forward to it. Is there a talent agent in the audience? I have always wanted to be on a stage like this, and the lights and everything, and Caroline had volunteered to play some music, but I wanted to do my Blanche Dubois impression from Streetcar Named Desire. So I'm going to try not to get too theatrical, but this really is tempting. All my life I wanted to be a movie star, but I wasn't, so... But I've been an actress all my life. As my sponsor says, I've been acting all my life, and I've given lots of good Academy Award-winning performances. I've just never gotten paid for any of it. Some of it I got paid for, but the money was not well earned. But anyway, I am here today, and I'm sober, and I'm alive, and I'm very grateful for that. I am just the warm-up act for the Sharon Barker. I know that that's what we're all waiting for. I love Sharon. She's a friend of mine, and we've talked this week, and I did this another time we were in Pennsylvania together, and I was on before her, and that was real intimidating for me because I've always been a rabid Elvis Presley fan. Oh boy, I love Elvis. I have pictures of him. I've got a shrine at home. I go to Graceland. But I remember going to a lot of his concerts. And you're all so young, you could not possibly know what an experience it would be to go to an Elvis Presley concert. There was nothing like him ever in the whole world, and there never will be. You would remember. Well, I went to several concerts, and I always felt so sorry for his warm-up acts because, of course, they couldn't have a musician because nobody could dare touch the stage with him. And there'd be these pitiful comedians who would try their best to... You know, the audience was just saying, and after 5 minutes, it's like, boo, hiss, get off stage, we want him. But anyway, I told her that I would do the best job I could, and I can do this, and tonight I can sleep well, and tomorrow I have a wonderful time with the steps. And the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to talk in the morning on sponsorship. Those two things are absolutely... The most important, there are no words to describe the transformation that can come about in your lives, which has happened in mine, as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and having a good sponsor. So you have picked the very best topics. And I think that by the time we leave here Sunday, we're all going to go away with something added to us and enhanced. My life is enhanced every time. The power that we're all seeking that we never had before is here when we come together. But it is literally nothing short of a miracle that I'm standing up here tonight, and this program to me, after the years that I've been here, indeed I do know that the drink is but a symptom, that alcoholism is a lot different than I ever could have imagined it could be. But I have learned so much that it's about feelings, it's about emotions and instincts on rampage, it's about the choices that I made in my life, and it's so much more than that, and that's what conferences like this are about. This is an 11th step in action, all of us coming together to seek to continue to seek His knowledge and His will for us, and the power, giving us the power to carry it out, and this is the way that I get it, is coming to things like this. But it is about the patterns of life that come about, and all of us have experienced the same thing. We all had different circumstances, but we've all had the same feelings, same emotions. All of those things have been the same. So no matter what the age difference, you know, I'm an old lady. I turned 50 this year, and boy, is that something else, because for somebody like me, so vain and whatever, it's tough. And a lot of other things go along with it, but I do know that my sponsor turned 80 this year, and a lot of you are just so young, but we've all got the same feelings, and we're all here for the same reasons. But the most important thing for me about this program, it's about the separation from God that I experienced early on, and I know that's really what it's all about, is the separation from God that I experienced, and His endless love and amazing, amazing grace that has brought me back in such a way that it's not even coming back to anything. It's like a whole new life. It's a whole new world for me, and I'm grateful for that. This story is real boring. It's real dull, and sobriety is far more exciting to me, and it is exciting. It's the most glorious. You know, when I was a little girl, all I ever wanted to be was something and somebody and have the fame and the fortune, and all that I've managed to do, the only thing that I can give, take or have to my credit, it's that I'm a good sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really, there's nothing, absolutely nothing else that could make me any happier or fill me up any more than that very thing right there. So I am grateful, but I usually start it depending on what's going on in my life. I'll start the story in the treatment center, or I'll start it wherever, just whatever hits me. But I think tonight I'm going to start just at the beginning and let you know that I was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1947. Isn't that a long time ago? My gosh. But I was the middle child, had two brothers, and I read a book recently that's talking about middle children, and I thought, God, that's been my problem all along. I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a middle child. And I just thought I could have really taken that one and gone with it had I read that book a long time ago. But my parents were in their late 30s when they had us, you know, they got started late in life, and I'm so eternally grateful they're both still alive. My dad's 82, mother's 86, and I'm grateful that I was able to get sober and to make the amends to them. But they had come to Atlanta from really dirt poor rural kind of roots, and they came to Atlanta for a better life, and they were educated. They were the only two members really of both their families who had any education, but they understood early on the importance of education and what it could do to enhance a person's life. And that was really important as far as the structure of the life that they gave us. But they left behind, they came from this setting, just a really real rural, real poor setting, to come to Atlanta. And Atlanta has always been a very sophisticated and very cosmopolitan city, not like it's not now. It's almost unbelievable in its growth and everything, but it's always been the place that you would go to if you lived in Georgia. Outside of Atlanta, there ain't nothing. There's just nothing. But anyway, they did, and they came to Atlanta and started their life here. In fact, they had their 58th wedding anniversary last week, and I thought that was really neat. But anyway, in addition to that, they had real strong traditions and religious roots. My dad's a Southern Baptist preacher, and he preached in churches around Atlanta for years and years and years, until he, in recent years, he's become too ill to do that. But they came to Atlanta, and we had this kind of setting to grow up in, so you can well imagine what it was like. But we moved into a community, a real community, unlike anything you see today, and now I can appreciate it all, but I couldn't at the time. But it was lovely. It was a nice middle-class community, and we had schools, and we had churches and neighbors and friends, everything you could ever really want. And when I tell this story, I still to this day am amazed at my perception of what I thought my life was like at one time, and it's a result of this program and the honesty that has to come eventually with us all. And I could begin to look back on it and see that it wasn't really much at all like I thought it was. But early on, I began to develop my own perception of the way things really were, based on fact and to some degree. But all of us kids were pretty sensitive from the start, just real sensitive people. And you know how the book even says, I think there's a one-liner in the big book says, "We alcoholics are sensitive people." No kidding. But we were not like the other kids. We didn't have the money, the material things. My family had a lot of rural ways about them that kind of, from the start, would embarrass me because it wasn't sophisticated. And we didn't seem to have the things the other kids had. And Mother worked all my life, although I never remember her really not being there, but still they both worked, and we were raised by various housekeepers, and other people had their mothers at home and stuff like that. And Daddy being a preacher, of course, we were expected to be good all the time. And we, having the Baptist background, which today I have absolutely no quarrel with, but I sure did develop a resentment early on because we couldn't smoke, of course. We couldn't smoke. We couldn't drink, of course. We sure couldn't curse. If I said the word gosh, I got a whipping. We couldn't play cards. We couldn't play games that had dice in them. We couldn't do anything on Sunday. I couldn't wear shorts on the street. I couldn't go to the movies. And yet they would say, now go on out and get along with everybody. Go on out and fit into the community. Go on and make friends. Be a part of. Well, that didn't work too well because it was real confusing to me. And there were things that early on that other things that would add to this kind of total confusion about what am I supposed to do, because not only had that conflict were we faced with, but any kind of feelings or emotions or anything like that were dismissed out of hand. Just, you know, you don't feel those things, you shouldn't feel that way. I used to hear that a lot. And all of these things, and I'm only saying these things because I am not a person who believes in inner child stuff and all of these things, simply because for me, I have managed to become sober and to grow up and be a responsible grown-up adult without having to do too much inner child work. Today I treat my inner child with a candy bar if she gets upset or cries. But there were things though that were important at the time and had played a big part in my perceptions. But if we misbehaved, we just were instantly punished. Daddy took a belt to us. We had a lot of beatings going on when I was growing up. But I eventually learned that's the way he was raised, and that's all he knew to do. But my family, I'm just mentioning them because they've become the most important at this stage of my sobriety. And we all go through stages, and different things are going to mean something to you as you progress, not only through sobriety, but as you age and get older. But my older brother, whatever frustrations he might have had, he channeled in different ways. He became the most popular kid in school, the president of the student body. He had friends galore everywhere. He was treated the harshest by my parents because they were older and they kind of experimented on him. But he did seem to make his way. Eventually, he would go into the military. That would be the way he would get the structure in his life. He married a woman, a glorious human being, from a very wealthy family, and had a family, and life worked out for him. My younger brother was more laid back, easygoing, great sense of humor. He got away with murder. Oh, God, anything he did. And there I am kind of languishing in between. But my younger brother did the same thing. His frustrations, whatever happened with him, he managed. He was popular. We all went to college and got all that stuff going on, but he had all the friends and went to college and graduated, became a teacher, married a wealthy woman from a wealthy family, and he's got two wonderful children, and he did good. We've all still had the sensitivity and emotions, but they didn't really take them too far out of bounds. Well, I became an alcoholic, a drug addict, a whore, a liar, a cheat, a thief. I ended up suicidal and in mental institutions. So, you know, that goes to tell you something about alcoholism. I don't know where it comes from in families, but I seem to be the one that just ended up in outer space. The other two, at least, managed to stay somehow on this planet, but I didn't. And that's real important, because here again, we all had same family, same background, same upbringing, but there was something missing in me that seemed to be at least there for them. I mean, some kind of something inside of them, a core to their very being. I don't think that I could have even identified that. But the negative emotions, the bad attitudes, the destructive behavior, the resentments, all of these things that led me to, they just led me straight to death's door. I've always said the two greatest things that ever happened in my life was when I first had my first drink of alcohol and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But all of these things started out early, and my older brother, for example, to overcome any fears he might have, they both learned to swim. My older brother learned to jump out of airplanes they were fearless. I was afraid of the dark. I never learned to swim. I developed fears of just death and dying and anything you could name. And it seemed, and I can remember, I have a mind like a steel trap. Now, not so much today. It's more kind of mushy because I lose it sometimes. I forget where I am. But I always remember details about everything that went on in my life. I can remember when I was 10 months old and I've described things to my mother and she'd say, "How could you do that?" But it's just that kind of sensitivity and whatever it is that was going on with me. But all of this stuff, all of these things, and not having what the other kids did and feeling not a part of, and kids would play with me and they were friends and things, but what we do as alcoholics is as kids do, they'll play with you and be your friend and then suddenly they won't be. Well, other kids can just go on and get over it. I never could get over it. And I began to store these things in my mind. And I could never feel enough or good enough. I was just to be ordinary. I never even felt ordinary. Much less being extraordinary. It was just ordinary people seemed to know what to do, where to go, how to do it. I had never had that sense. And at Christmas time, Christmas is the time of the year that I struggle with the most. I have some depression still in my life, and it's just kind of it's a chemical thing because I have seasonal disorders that kind of come and go, but I don't dwell on them because it's just a fact of life. And where there's winter and dark, there's always going to be spring and light. So that's what I know, and I don't have to worry about it. But every year and throughout my life, all the suicide attempts would come at Christmas. And it started, though, with little things of not getting what I wanted at Christmas. And what I wanted was it was never much. I never asked for that much, but it was what the other kids had so that I could feel a part of. Well, my parents couldn't really afford it, and they weren't deliberately withholding stuff from me, but that's where the resentment started and the attitudes and the "I'll show you." And that's what led to a life of destruction, unbelievable to me. A life where I destroyed everybody who came in my path, and myself unbelievably so, but a life that I never, never would have imagined. And it just started there and it moved on up. And I thank God that I don't have to dwell in that today. But public humiliation, I remember experiencing that and how it felt. That's all. That's how it felt. Was just horrid. It was something I could not get over. And these things, when we get to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and we talk about instincts on rampage, the basic instincts for sex security and rightful place in society, the emotional security, financial security, and all these things that are God-given, and everybody has them, every human being has them, they begin to, the color, there was a different, I saw the world in a different way, and they started early, very early on. I wore glasses when I was 7 years old, and back then, I always had a saying, boys don't make passes at girls who wear glasses. Isn't that clever? I love that. That's so clean compared to other things they say today. But anyway, I had to wear glasses, and also about 8 years old, I was struck so ugly you wouldn't believe it. Because back then we had those pointy little glasses, you know, that went up. Now I think they're cool, and I thought, you know, but at that time, I just was so humiliated, and I began to mature earlier than the other girls. In the sixth grade, I was taller than any of the boys in the class, and I was bigger than anybody. And the other girls were little bitty, scrawny things, and here all this stuff's happening in my body, and I'm wearing glasses, and I'm ugly, and I'm just all the, you know, and I just go around like this all the time, and I can't stand the feeling, and no boyfriends. And all the only thing that I could do to really make myself feel better was to go into this little fantasy land. When I was a little girl, I'd go in my room after school and lock the door, and that's where all the theatrics and the fantasy world started for me, because I could be anybody in the whole world. And I loved Elvis Presley, like I said. Oh my goodness, and listen to those songs, and he'd be singing just to me. Connie Francis was a really big star back then. Nobody in this audience has probably heard of her but you and y'all. But anyway, I learned every word to every song she ever sung, and the wall would be my audience, and I would sing to the wall, and then I would do all this. It was wonderful. And I could just pretend, and it worked out. And I could be, especially wanted to be Elizabeth Taylor, and so I had black hair anyway, so I pretended my eyes were purple, and I could be her. So this is, you know, I'm talking about before 9 years old. This is only just the setup. And 9 years old, though, was the time. That was the big turning point. That was 1956, and I was 9 years old. Elvis Presley came on the scene. By the way, today I work in politics. I work for the Georgia State Senate. I've always had a bizarre fascination with politicians, which might tell you something about me, if nothing else. But I even remember the conventions, the Democrat-Republican convention in 1956. I watched that on TV. But at that time, I had something happen to me. Two or three things started happened to me right then, and the progression began. The first thing was, the neighborhood was packed with, you know, different people of different groups and everything, but they were everybody seemed to be really good, but they were what we used to call hoods. I love it. You know, life's so different now. It's so vulgar now compared to, but the hoods, the worst thing they would do would be drink beer and smoke cigarettes. Well, I just really was attracted to that because they were so hip, slick, cool, and they looked like, you know, the slick hair, and it was just really neat. And they'd carry their Marlboros in the sleeve, and I just thought that was so cool. And I liked the girls who wore the real tight skirts and the big hairdos and chewed the gum and wore the pointed glasses and smoked cigarettes. And I had a neighbor who smoked cigarettes, and one day she asked me if I'd like a drag. And I said, well, sure. And I said, well, sure, mainly because I wanted her to like me. Well, I remember that first puff because I just about died. I just about fainted. It was just unbelievable, strong, you know, just everything. But I took the puff, and I smoked that cigarette down and began to smoke at 9 years old. And not too long after that, I got the beating of my life from my daddy about it because he caught me, but still it didn't stop me. Unfortunately, it didn't stop me because anything that would make me feel a part of or make me feel better of any kind, that's what I was going to do, and I was going to make it work. But I did take the cigarette at 9. The next thing that happened soon thereafter. I was with a girlfriend, and one thing that other families also did that mine didn't, and I was forever comparing, I was ever watching, and I do that today, and it's to my favor today because I watch people in this program. That's the way I've learned, and that's the way I have brought the very finest teachers into my life, because I picked out the ones that I want what they have, but I watch them. I see how they live their life and what they do. But I watched other families and compared everything, and most other families in our neighborhood had alcohol in their home. There was never a drop of alcohol served in my home. Nobody drank. My parents did not drink. There were alcoholics in the family, but that was never mentioned like that. It was a sin. Your Southern Baptist family, you don't do that. But anyway, I went to a girlfriend's house. Her mother offered me a drink. She had a iced tea glass with some bourbon, straight bourbon in it, asked me if I wanted a drink. Well, the same reason that I took the cigarette, I took the drink. And I remember it as if it were yesterday, the feeling that I got from that drink. Like everybody else does the first time you take a drink, and especially straight bourbon, for God's sake, I just choked to death, and the burning, it went down. But I remember almost instantly the feeling that came over me. And after just a little while and taking some more of that drink, I don't even think I ever got sick. I was never one to really even get sick, throw up, or do any of that stuff, because I seemed to be able to have a capacity for a lot of liquor. But at that time, I just remember how good I felt, what it did for me. And that's what the books tell us. It's part of what an alcoholic really is, because I remember that feeling. But that, and instantly I knew. And it was like I'd found the best friend that I'd ever had, and indeed, alcohol became the best friend that I ever had in my life and brought me to you to this day, because had I not found alcohol, I am convinced beyond measure that with the loneliness, the pain, the sorrow, the sadness that I seemed to just a black cloud that hung over me, I would have been dead a long time ago, because I didn't know how to live this life or how to be a part of, or anything, and I didn't have a clue how to do it. But suddenly life did change for me. And from that moment on, I began to pursue the drink and what it would do for me and get it in any way that I could on to the gates of hell until I was 34 years old. The next thing that happened for me, you know, and one thing I do want to say, what it did for me then was why I drank for so long until it finally turned on me, was because when I would take a drink, I felt like you looked like you were feeling, which to me was normal and happy and free. And that's what I thought that most normal people would feel, they felt all the time, with or without a drink. So that's that special magic that came to me early on. But the next thing that happened, and I mention these things because it does form a core of everything, my dear poor mother did it, something that was absolutely, to this day, she cannot believe she did it, but she didn't do it on purpose. In the 50s, amphetamines were freely, they flowed freely. You didn't even have to have prescriptions for some of them. But my mother gave me my first amphetamines because I was also very chubby, and she knew I was concerned about that and didn't have boyfriends and whatever. And I had my first amphetamines when I was around 9 years old, too. So, boy, was that a magic time for me, because all of a sudden, my whole world changed, and it was complete. Within not too long after that, my world was complete, because with alcohol, that was a bridge to you, and I could flow freely, and I could be pretty. I could do everything that everybody else did and feel normal and never afraid. And with the amphetamines, the pattern that developed there, I could do everything. And I mean everything. Stay up for a week, it didn't matter. I could do everything. And I didn't have to prove anything to anybody. And I could excel in things. And you see, there we go from just trying to be ordinary to suddenly, I'm going to be better than. And that was pretty much the start. And the next thing that came along that kind of really did complete this was that I discovered sex. Now, a 10-year-old having sex is a pretty disgusting thing, but when you're as needy a person as I was, and had no boyfriends, and had all of these feelings of being dropped from outer space and whatever, I discovered that, you know, that was one way you could get attention from a boy. Even if it was temporary. And those early experiences, they're real painful for me because they were very degrading and very stupid and very everything. But as I can look back on it, I can see that's just the way my life had to be. It really had to be that way because that completed it and made it start. My life started about there. So, in order to do these things, I had to develop some skills, and I became very skilled, a master of deception. I had to learn to manipulate people, my parents especially, to get out of the house, to do the things that I wanted to do. I had to become a really good liar, and I don't remember that being part of my nature or makeup when I was a younger kid. But, you know, a liar must of necessity have a damn good memory or he's sunk. And I had a good memory, and I could keep... I worked, operated, is a key word, for a long time because I could remember, you know, you got to remember what you told somebody over here the next day and all of this stuff. But I began to develop all of these skills and to do these things by necessity. And, you know, that's that easing into that separation from the God of my family, from the structure of my family, from the community. You just begin, it's real insidious, and it starts somewhere. But I go to the slumber parties and drink and get into people's liquor cabinets and do all of these things. And rolled into high school and added another skill to my repertoire. You know, I'm growing up to be a real fine daughter. I'm growing up to be a good citizen because in addition to the alcohol, the drugs, the sex, and all of these other things that are going on, I added shoplifting and stealing to my repertoire. You know, it's kind of like building a resume. But because I didn't have things materially, and I always felt less than, I wanted to buy people's affection and love. And so if I, and we all had to work. I resented that. We had to work from the time we were young. So I worked at a department store after school and high school and just stole them blind. And I could do that real well. I never got caught at it, but one time I got caught, but I talked my way out of that, and that's the best thing I ever learned to do, was to talk my way out of everything I ever got into. That's the actress in us all, that we can if, I wish I'd gotten caught sometimes, but you know, it worked out the way it was supposed to work out. But I never was enough, and I never had enough. So this was just the way it went. And as I went into high school, you know, when you've got all this stuff in you, all of a sudden you start looking around at all these people that you've been just begging for their attention. You've been pleading, you've been crying, you've been hoping, you've been wishing. And you start looking at them and they look different. They don't look so cool anymore. And they're not, so I don't need to be with that crowd. They're so boring, for God's sake. What do I need that for? I am cool in and of myself. And I began to hate the cheerleaders, especially still. I went to a 35-year reunion or something a few years ago, and the cheerleaders are all fat, and I am so happy for that. And I do not mean to be disrespectful, but I'm telling you, the cheerleaders and the majorettes in high school all had these little figures, and they could do cartwheels, and I couldn't do a cartwheel. And, you know, in my life, I thought because I couldn't do a cartwheel, I wanted to kill myself one time. I decided to try to commit suicide because I couldn't do a cartwheel. And, I couldn't do these things. So I was real pleased to see that they got kids. They got a million kids, and they look tired. Well, I'm feeling good, but anyway, I decided, you know, I got to get out of this. I got to break out of this place. This attitude started developing. It's like this is really all. You know, my parents had raised us in the church, raised us in athletics and sports. We were all we did all these things, and I was on the school newspaper. We took music. I was very musically, you know, I could do all those things. And all this stuff going on, but life's getting to be a drag. Got to get out of here. Got to go on and make my mark. The church, I was beginning to really chafe at that. And that would be, you know, the thing that would finally make that separation so complete from God, because I had gone to church like a good girl and done all these things, but I'm beginning to look at my parents and get that feeling every time I look at them. If you just give me what all these other people had, just a fair chance, and you haven't done it, and it's at church, and all these people, and now I started looking at the hypocrites, and they go do you know, that surly, smart attitude. So I skipped the 11th grade because I wanted to go on, move out, and get out of there. I've never left Atlanta. That's the only thing I never did. The only thing that never changed, that was consistent in my life. I never left home, except for the brief time that I went to college. But at 17, I skipped a grade, and at 17, I'm off to college, and that's going to make a difference. Well, I went to Auburn, Alabama, and I made that decision, one of the big, big decisions of my life when I left home, that I would never darken the door of a church again, that God would not be a part of my life ever again, that if indeed he was there, whatever he was, He gave me a brain and he gave me a life, and he intended for me to run it. And from that time on into this program, there was no God in my life. The agnostic, the chapter of the agnostic is a true, I've got every word underlined because that's what happened to me. But at that point, that's where my life really took off with the alcoholism. And by then, my alcoholism was full blown, because alcohol is a part of my life, such a part of my life, and the amphetamines and all the other things. But I went to college, and I felt free, and I would never be under anybody's rule again. And the books tell us about we dominate others or we're dependent on others. Of course, I've suffered from both of those all of my life. But I was going to take charge of my life, and that I did. I got involved in a sorority because I thought that was what you were supposed to do. But I'm going to be honest with you. I hate it absolutely. Auburn was excruciating for me because there were just a lot of things wrong with this thing. But I was thinking about the sorority business the other day. I didn't fit in there either. But all I ever learned in a sorority, now I'm not putting them down here again, I know some of you probably sorority girls, but back then everybody smoked cigarettes. We learned how to hold a cigarette. You never hold it down here, you always hold it up here, and you never walk on the street smoking a cigarette. I learned how and when to wear pearls, and all Southern women have pearls. And we also learned about thank you notes and manners, how important it is to write a thank you note for absolutely everything. And I've always said that's why Southern women don't get involved in orgies, is because it'd be too many thank you notes to write. And, that's the way I felt about it. It's like, this is too much trouble, because it was a thank you note for, thank you, thank you, thank you. But also, and I learned early on how to dress and look good, but to wear my hair up here in my sorority composite, we all look exactly alike. And I also learned the greatest thing, because, when you're really out there in the world and you're so worldly and all these things, I learned the Southern women's mating call. It's, oh, y'all, I am so drunk. And that starts off every relationship. I am so drunk. But, and also, I was a big, when I drank, I was a party girl, and loved to go to parties and always had parties. And I learned, I love to dance. And when I can't dance, but when I drank, I was Ginger Rogers, anybody I wanted to be, dancing on the ceiling, dancing on the tables, dancing on your head or wherever. But it was, for me, it was like, one tequila, two tequila, three tequila, floor. One tequila, two tequila, three tequila, four. And it went on like that. So this was, and I loved bourbon, I loved beer, and I loved tequila. Margaritas, gosh, it's just the word margarita. Marcia and a margarita. Doesn't that sound sophisticated? So I'm just in this world that is just so not real. But at that time it was, and it stayed that way. I also got involved. My whole life changed. My whole attitude changed because I'm in Alabama in the middle of the 60s, and civil rights movement's going on, and I just made my mark there. I could not believe what was going on around me, and in the South the attitudes were pretty strong, and I took a stand for civil rights. That's one place I seemed to have some courage, and I don't know where it came from, but I wasn't going to live like all those people that I've been raised with, all the bigots and the racist and whatever. And so I got involved in civil rights, and in the 60s I protested everything, anything that wasn't normal or I was carrying signs and waving flags and alienating every human being in my family, everybody in my community. But I really meant it. That felt right in my heart. And I began to, there was a core there of at least decency but it just meant a lot to me. But it also meant a lot to me to rebel like that and to be different from all of them and to show them. And I showed them. In fact, my older brother and I were so estranged for so many years. But one of the big problems was that I protested the Vietnam War also. I was out carrying signs and banners and waving flags and running my mouth. And he served two times in Vietnam in some of the worst battles that were there. And I'm home carrying signs against the war. And, you know, we've come to reconciliation on that point, because you can become so open-minded that your brains fall out, and mine did indeed on a lot of things. But anyway, this is what's going on. And I have to mention the Auburn football team, because I got involved in I had an incident with the Auburn football team. And this was not a pretty picture, let's just put it that way. And life just got hard. It really got hard, but it was time for me to come home. I stayed there 2 years, and there were no grades. I'm talking about my grades getting bad, there were just no grades. I didn't have time for that, but got in trouble with the football team, and that's what really brought me home. Daddy called me home, summoned me home, and I graduated.
Marsha!
They were going to do the Auburn football team cheer. Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Go on, Marsha. But anyway, I came home and graduated from college with degrees in history, political science, psychology, and sociology. Not that I was such a brilliant human being, but simply because I thought, out of one of those fields, I am going to be able to do something that's going to please my daddy, that's going to please me, that's going to make any sense. Whatever. It just went on and on. But at the very day I graduated, he said, well, you should have gone into business. You know, that's the kind of life that I lived with this man. And I took it all to heart. But defiance and rebellion and all of this was just so strong in me. But I graduated from college and immediately went to work as a social worker in a school for emotionally disturbed children. And would you want your child? And it's really sad, it really is. But I was there to help the parents. While the kids were getting help for all their problems, I was there to help the parents in the transition. And that was just so bizarre, and it's pretty sick, and it's pretty sad, too, because it's just not right. One of those times that I'm not very proud of. But the drinking, the parties, and the by this time, I had married the right man, and I say the right man because my family approved of him. He was so handsome. Oh, and the sex was so good, and God, that's on that tape, and I don't know about that. But it really, you know how we are, the in lust, and I thought, oh. And the 12 and 12 says that we need to be compatible spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. It doesn't even say physically, but everybody's got that perception, it's physically, emotionally, mentally, and what? You know, but anyway, but he was so intelligent, and he had great earning potential. And in other words, he could take care of me. So my addictions demanded that I marry a man such as this. And we got married, and the minute I married him, there was no feeling at all. And I was beginning to know at that time, although I didn't question it for a lot of years, I kept trying to find something to fill me up. But I kept thinking, whoa, there's something bad wrong here, because there isn't anything that can fill you up, girl. Everything you try just seems to just empty out real quick after you've done it. I wasn't one of these who'd just pick up a lot of stuff and drop them once I got them. It's just I'd work at them. But I just never had a feeling for much of anything, and it was beginning to really slip out of me. I had a lot of passions. I've always been a passionate human being, but they were directed in such a wrong way. But I had big plans, and I was going to marry and go have the career and get the big house and have the children and be somebody, and that was going to make it. Remember, God is nowhere to be found anymore in my life, and no family life, no association with that family of mine, because they were going to drag me down. And I proceeded to, the next few years, just completely sink to the gutter and lose any values that I had ever been given, and do pretty much everything that I never imagined as a human being that I could do. I ended up with people in places that I didn't want to be, doing things that I didn't want to, places I didn't really want to be in, that powerlessness, that personal powerlessness that I've suffered from all of my life, because I couldn't say no to anything. I had all of these, it's a bizarre, but this mental illness is what it was called. And during all these years, I was diagnosed as mentally ill by several doctors, and given all the labels that everybody always gives, the manic depressive, the schizoid, alienation, obsessive compulsive, anything you can name. And this had, in college especially, I saw
I don't know how many psychologists, and a lot of depressions led to suicide attempts and a lot of things that just nobody could talk about. And I'm just reeling through this world, just hurling to earth, kind of like a meteor just going to crash any minute. But I decided after we married, I'd have a child, and I have one daughter. She's 26 years old today, and we do have a glorious relationship. Thank God for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous that we've been able to do that. But the minute they brought her to me, I remember looking at her because I thought, she's going to make me feel better. She's going to be a mother. That's going to make me a human being again, and I'm going to be okay. But the minute she came to me, I didn't even know. I said, what am I supposed to do with her? And so from that, the start of that relationship, whatever, I had no, you know, after a while, we can't love anybody because we're so separated spiritually from the world and from the people and God, which is, that's what is God, is the people around us. I had no feeling inside of me for anybody else. It was just what I could get out of this world and what I could do to survive. And I was barely functioning as a human being, but thank God for alcohol. Oh, thank God for alcohol, because the feeling that could come over me, and there was peace, just like the still that you hear right here now. That's the way it sounded to me when I drank. It was so nice. But when I wasn't drinking, it was like a city street in Washington, D.C. or Atlanta, Georgia at any time of the day, and the going on in my head, that constant clatter, and that thinking I'm going insane, I am going to lose my mind. And the only thing that kept my mind fastened together was drugs and alcohol. And I mentioned drugs simply because it were a big part of my life. But anyway, I got into this and I opened a business and thought, that's going to do it, and went through all of this stuff, and I opened a clothing business and I did real well at it. I of course became obsessed and immersed in that, and financial insecurity had always been big for me. But we had a burglary in the store and we lost everything we had, and we got into debt, unbelievable debt of $250,000. It was just an incredible time. The 70s were not a good time for me. My daughter, I remember though that, and I was running around on my husband big time, and I remember going after work. I taught school in there somewhere for a little while. I'm always involved with kids. This is dangerous. Today I get along best with children, animals, and old people, but back then it was dangerous for me to be near any of them. But I remember stopping off after work with the teachers to drink and coming home, and my husband was in school and my daughter would be there with a sitter, and she was so young. And I remember one Halloween coming home and passing out in the house, and she was 2 years old, for God's sake, and she had to go to the door to help the trick-or-treaters because her mother was passed out, and that's the kind of life she lived. By the time, you know, we come to a place where it just doesn't work anymore, and that's really what began to happen to me, because the unmanageability of my life was I couldn't drink, I couldn't be sober, and I couldn't be drunk, and I couldn't stand it anymore. Everything really took a turn for me, and I just developed the thing, the light was finally gone by the late 70s, and the suicidal nature began to set in, and I had diaries that I cannot even believe when I read them today, but the suicide attempts became more, and I was not, I wasn't functioning. I was just not functioning. Before I could even speak to somebody, I'd have to write down what I was going to say. It was just so much stuff, and I don't want to dwell anymore on that because that's a long gruntologue, but it was really painful beyond words for everybody, because I wasn't just taking me down. I took everybody down, my entire family, and everybody, the friends that I had made, I looked around one day and I didn't want them anymore, and I didn't want it anymore, and it was like, what happened? Whatever happened, because I didn't mean for it to be this way, but it's not turned out the way I had planned. By the time, by 1981, I had been, we'd been to all the doctors, and we'd done all the things and tried everything, and I finally had, I
I'd had several nervous breakdowns when then these Southern women again, they have their nerves are bad, and I had bad nerves. But, you know, the reality of my life had been from the first drink on, my intellect had been eroded. My ability to reason had been eroded. And if you want to know the definition of insanity, that's what it is, that we cannot grasp the reality of our lives. And I had not an ounce of ability to grasp the reality, and I was in that state. That's what insanity is talking about, I believe, in the books. And the deaf ear that I had turned to God, and I turned my back on God for so long, and there was no God in my life and no core in my soul. And you see, I know today through this program that God, when he made me, he had a special place, a certain place there that only he could fill, a special place in me for him. Nothing else in the whole wide world is ever going to fill it, and there's no way to do it. But I didn't know that at that time. But I had finally gotten to that point, and I had the final nervous breakdown of whatever you want to call it in May of 1981, and I went to a doctor in Atlanta who immediately told me something that for the moment sounded good, because I'd never one time considered alcoholism. I had never heard of it, known of it, did not know a thing. I knew everything else in the world but that term and what that meant. Today, I know I'm an alcoholic, and you know what? That's all I need to know about myself. And all I need to know is what it means. And I find out what it means when I read the books of this program and when I do the steps and when I'm with you. That's all in the world I need to know. I don't need anything else, because it's told me exactly, and it's enabled me to come back to life, to have a life again. But I went into a treatment center in Pennsylvania, and I was very, very ill in every way, and spiritually, morally, physically, everything I was just destroyed, and the family was destroyed, and I had done it almost single-handedly, and none of them knew what was wrong. Nobody knew what was wrong. It's just the most bizarre thing in this world. But I came out of the treatment center. I was real popular in the treatment center because, you know, the first thing to recover is the ego. And after I'd gotten out of that detox where I'd been strapped to a bed and sick as a dog, and oh yes, I'll do anything. Well, when you got to feeling better, and I'm charming, and I'm Southern, and I'm up in Pennsylvania, and they're talking about all that accent and all that stuff, and all the men, you know, men, I love men, I always have, and I became a greeting committee for the men who would come into the treatment center, and you know, a guy would pull up in a car, and I'd go out to shake his hand and welcome him to the treatment center. But this, you know, kind of kept me distracted while I was there. But I came home and thought, everything's going to be just fine. Well, it was not just fine. Life is not just fine. For an alcoholic like me, I didn't know this at the time, but when I am not drinking is when the problem is really going to develop. That is where the problem is, because I have absolutely nothing to fill up the hole that alcohol did, and to get what it gave to me. And what it did was to keep me functioning. It kept the world at bay, and it kept me halfway sane. Without it, I am completely out of control. The restless, irritable, discontent, those words are so mild for me. I'm coming apart any minute. But I came home and had to face the wreckage of the past, and over the next few years I would deal with that. And I lost, in a nutshell, I lost, of course, the business, my husband, my child, my home, everything that was material, that was dear to me. I had no relationship with my parents whatsoever. I had broken their hearts. I had alienated every friend that I had. I had no money, no credit, no absolutely any thing to even call my own, and I was very, very much of a shame to myself and to everybody else. But I came home from treatment and came to AA meetings because I was told to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that that's where I would, if I would do the work, the program, and do the best I could, then this is a disease that can't be cured, but that I could at least live with it, and I might could even be happy. Well, being as dishonest and not having any clue as to what honesty means, when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you just come in and you comply instead of rely, then not much changes, and nothing did change for me. I didn't take a drink. But I acted like a drunk, thought like a drunk, behaved like a drunk, so nothing changed. Well, as you know, if you're an alcoholic and if you've been here a while, the progression of the disease is there whether you're drinking or not. But the first thing I did when I came in, and I have to tell this always because everybody, there's half of you done this and you know people who have, but the first thing I did once I got in, I've been here about a month, was to go to the only addiction I could drag up that I had left. This man who was 12 years sober comes over and says, "You're so pretty, I can help you." And I said, "I bet you can." And sure enough, you know, as somebody in this program says, a mind-altering, mood-changing man, that's what I got. And so for the next 2 years, as my family deteriorated and everything got worse and worse and worse, and I hung out with him. I went to meetings just to see him, and as stupid as we are, we'd go into meetings, and I looked like $1 million, and we'd go into meetings, we'd hold hands behind the chair like nobody could see us and all this dumb stuff. But I went to meetings, and I got a sponsor who, absolutely, I'm always be grateful to her for at least what she did for me in the beginning, because I looked across the room, and there's something in that room. See, today I know the power that we all want, that switch to go on, is in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where God is, because when he's in every one of us and he brings us together, here he is. And if I go to a meeting and if I'm truly wanting to be sober, he's going to tell me through people exactly what I can do to get better. But I wasn't listening. I wasn't doing anything except just showing up and complying one more time. But I would go places with her, and thank God for that. I've got 5 women with me tonight, and I hope you all get to know every one of them, because they're a team of experts. This crowd down here they've all been on wanted posters in every post office in the United States in one way or another. But they are sober women, and they are happy women, and we're growing up. We're taking responsibility for ourselves, and that type of friendship, that type of love cannot be bought or found anywhere else. But it starts with those initial contacts in these meetings and looking across the room and making an eye contact with somebody somewhere who's going to be the one, an instrument, and I believe every single one of you are an instrument of God. He brings me to you and you to me to tell us we're going to all learn something that he wants us to know about ourselves. But that first sponsor took me places. I dragged them this crowd, I've got a bunch of them left at home, and I wish they were all here, but I never travel without at least one of them. But it's like I say, come on, let's go, because that's what my sponsors have done for me. And I'm going to talk to you a lot about sponsorship in the morning, so I don't want to really dwell on tonight, because I love that subject. It has saved my life and been one of the greatest joys I've ever had, being sponsored and sponsoring people. But anyway, she would take me to make me go to conventions. She would make me chair meetings and do all these things, and I'd do it just to see this guy, but I would show up. But finally, you know, time goes on, and the husband's gone, and the child, my child was emotionally ill at this point, so sick. The pain that I feel today when I look at her and some of the problems that she has today, they all go back to me. But we get better, because God's been good to me, and he's allowed forgiveness to go between us just through action and through me staying sober and trying to live this program. But she developed epilepsy also at that time, so things were really tough, and I was getting sicker and sicker too, because you see, everything was beginning to wear off, and this man wasn't looking so attractive anymore. And we all come to that place. The very vehicle that we think we need the most is going to be what gets us to our knees. I believe that with all my heart. And at that point in time, I had reached that bottom, that emotional bottom that takes some of us to come into this program and stay here a while and know that just not drinking and just going to meetings for a drunk like me ain't going to get it, because there is no worse hell than not having a drink, not being able to drink and not being able to be sober. And I came to 2 years of sobriety, and I went to the Atlanta Roundup, and I had been the year before, but I'll never forget it as long as I live. It was July the 16th, 1983. I went and I said, I'm going to go one more time. I can't live this life. I'm going to go tonight,
But tomorrow I'm out of here. I don't know if it's going to be a gun to my head or what it's going to be, but I'm out of here. That's it. One more time, those two big decisions. And I went to that meeting that night, and I sat in that chair, and I heard a speaker. And that's why I don't not go to these conferences. Please, you girls are so smart. You women are so smart to go to everything you can, because you don't know when the person that's going to be there is going to tell you what God wants you to know. But I went that night, and that's the first night I heard Clancy, and Clancy is indeed instrumental. He saved my life. He literally did, mainly because he was the instrument that I could hear. He was the one I could hear, and he talked about alcoholism, it being a feeling disease, and he talked about the perceptions and how what we're like when we're not drinking, and then when we quit drinking, exactly what happens, and I heard it. I remember I began to shake. I did not know what was going on inside of me, but I knew something was going on. And I just heard him. The next 6 months were pure hell for me, because I know that that was the night that I began, the real me, the old me, began to die. But I had to go through a lot of hell the next 6 months. And 6 months later, I had a gun to my head, and I pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off. My daughter had said something real basic and real nothing, but it set me off, and that was the final blow. And I went in the bedroom and took a gun that my husband had left in the closet, and I took it and put it to my head without any. And there was a moment of peace there, a moment of clarity, that I knew what was going to happen, and I was hoping it would truly happen. No fear. That's one of those moments. It's an incredible experience, but it didn't go off. And the next thing I knew, my sponsor was there. You see, that's the amazing grace of this program, because I hadn't done anything, but I had, at least I did have her. And I don't know, and we got on our knees to pray. I had never done that in my life, prayed on my knees. And we prayed the old alcoholic prayer, God help her, and God, and he did. I began to do things that, because I had given up. My third step was certainly, these steps as we go through them with Sharon, and I can't wait. Some of them you can just put them, get them real simple. And for me, it was just simply throwing up my hands and saying, I give up whatever it takes. I didn't really want to be sober. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to live. But it really didn't matter. It mattered only in that, okay, maybe I can do it. Maybe I'm defeated. And I couldn't have taken those first two steps, those first 2 years, because I had no honesty and no sense of what this thing is all about and the fatal nature of this disease. But I did indeed take that third step at that point in time. And my life, it's like, absolutely. I don't think that when we talk in the third step about turning our will and our lives over, I do believe in the concept of turning around and facing God. Because I turned my back on God, and I turned around and I began to face God for the first time ever. And God for me, though, was not you. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous were my God and my higher power, let's put it that way. I didn't even talk about God in the second step. I don't need to talk about God there. All I need to know is you've got power. You have power. And I saw it and I felt it and I experienced it and was living in spite of myself. So I gave my life over to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to the people in it. And it was whatever you said, wherever I, whatever it takes, I will do it. And at that point in time, indeed, my life began to change. And so, and it took a long, long, long time. I've been sober over 16 years. And to this day, it is a journey that I would not have missed for anything, but I feel like I'm just beginning, because I was so sick for so long that it's tough. Some of us get it quicker than others, but for me it was not easy, simply because but I have been willing to do, and when you take actions, and it is a program of actions, it's incredible what can happen. But I got involved with a man again, but in a different way, unlike any that I had ever known. There was a man in a meeting one night, and I'd heard him, I'd been in meetings with him before. He didn't want anything for me at all, except he was a very spiritual man. And we began to go to meetings together, and this was important for me because I could actually be honest with a man and not try to con him or use him or abuse him or try to get something out of him that would only last for a moment in time. And after a long time, though, after several months, there was no romance involved. It was purely and simply, that was the last thing I needed, and I sure didn't want it. But we began to get involved emotionally,
And eventually we did get married, and we had a 12th wedding anniversary in May, and it's been a glorious marriage simply because it's really been wonderful, and I'll tell you why. He's one of the most spiritual people I've ever known because he's the most grounded person I've ever known. He told me something early on that some women just pass out and faint at, and I did, I can tell you this. But he told me that I would never be, he would never allow me to be dependent on him for anything, emotionally, spiritually, financially, physically, or mentally. And I thought, well, what am I doing here, please? what do you do when you're married then? But he told me that I would have to get a sponsor, and that my sponsor would be the most important person in my life, and that I would get priorities in my life, that I could set them any way I wanted them to be, but that his, he could suggest to me, his were, his program came first before anything, anybody, anywhere. His spiritual growth would always be in front of everything, me included. His job would come second because I had never paid my own way, and I had been so dependent on other people to pay my way through my life, and I could use and abuse them and get what I wanted and never have to pay any consequences or take responsibility for. But a job, if I would get a job and pay my own way and my own bills and take care of myself, that's where I would gain some sense of self-respect. And I don't like the phrase self-esteem, because if you're always looking for self-esteem means you got to feel good all the time, and that ain't life. That's not humility, because the good and the bad of us is going to be times we don't feel so good, and that's what we're made up of, is good and bad and not so great and all of these things. But self-respect is a term that means a lot to me, because I had none, and I respected none of you either. But I learned respect at the hands of you people when I could respect my sponsor, and when I could respect you in meetings and this program. I could learn to respect myself, and as a result I could get some integrity, and I could get some humility, and I could get, see, I don't have to work for these things or work on these things. They come as a result. These are the gifts, the precious gifts that the steps of the program give us. With each step that we take, there is a gift to be given, and that's what it's all about for me. But I began to get involved in the first place he took me, were step studies, big book studies, and I got the sponsor of the love of my life, one of the most glorious women, and I have the most respect for her to this day. But she was at that time, and she has a reputation, she was just, I'd look in the big book. I thought she had to be in the big book, because I'd hear people say, Maggie Harrison, they'd quote her and whatever, but I heard she was so mean, and that she was she could make grown men cry, and I thought, And at first I never wanted to be around her, because I heard that she could spot a liar at a New York Minute and she'd tell you about it, and I was scared of her. But at that point in time, I made another big decision that I was going to turn my life over to the very best that there is. And I had to change sponsors, because we didn't work the steps, and we didn't do the things that I needed. I didn't need somebody as sick as me helping me. And I went to the best, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and we took the third step together on a mountaintop in Tennessee. And from that day forward, she began to teach me things, and I began to listen. And when I began to listen, I've always loved good teachers. And I listened and I watched her, and to this day, we've been together about 12 years, and to this day, everything about her, I love. She had what I wanted. She had what I needed, and she was willing to give it to me, but I was going to have to pay a price, and that was to get rid of me, to teach me how to get out of myself. Everywhere she said go, I went. Every place she said stand, I stood. Every time she took my inventory, that was just fine with me, and I was willing to go to any length. And she was tough, and she is tough, but the dearest, sweetest, she's loved me so, because she didn't worry about hurting my feelings if it would mean saving my life, and I appreciate that. And that's the way I get to sponsor people today. And if you're in a relationship like that, that's where we learn about love. That's where I learned about love, what it means. But I began to get involved, and she had a step study that we took 12 and 12, and we took the steps a paragraph at a time, and I learned them paragraph at a time. And by the way, I think if you take summers off, it takes about 6 years to go through the 12 and 12 a paragraph at a time for whatever useless information that is. But anyway, I did that. But earlier, right before that, I'd started my own step study, and it was for the wrong reasons. But I'd hated women. Oh, I couldn't stand women to be around women. And I was told that I needed to be around women. And of course I need to be around women, because you know me. You know exactly. You know my game. You know how I operate. You know when I'm lying. You know everything about me. And I had always worked well, much better with men. I love men. And I like to, because I can con any man. I haven't found one yet. I still can't con. But anyway, my attitude, you know, everything had to be changed. And I had to learn about where the old attitudes had taken me, and the obsessions that had driven me, and that had driven any other thoughts out, and how my mind had been so twisted. And I had to do these steps and to work a four-step that would truly begin to get inside of me, so that I could begin to do this process and come to understand what it was all about. But I had to have the help of women, and I got involved. I started my own step study, and I did it simply because I felt, well, I don't like women, but I can pick the ones I want to come to the meeting, and the ones who don't like me and I don't like, they won't come, and this is good. But you know what? God has been good in my life, and He took over that meeting, and the meeting is the strongest meeting, and I will say this, I will put it up against any meeting in this entire world. It's a Tuesday night step study, and there are about 30 of us who meet, and we try to keep it even between 20 and 25. And girls are always saying, Marcia, you hadn't offended anybody lately. There's too many women coming in here. But we do it. We take the steps through both books, and we work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been doing that meeting for 12 years now. And I'm the founder, and I like to, you know, sit there like Clancy says and be a founder kind of thing. But God takes over the minute we open the books. But that started in there, because I was just learning how to work the steps. And with her, through that meeting and her meeting and going to study meetings and speaker meetings, I began to change my entire perception, begin to be altered. Terrible things happened in these times, because I was having to learn to grow up and take responsibility, but to see some mighty ugly things. When I was about 4 or 5 years sober, I almost killed my daughter. One night, the anger, the anger and the rage and stuff that kind of builds up inside of us. And I'm trying to do this program, but I'm in a house that's fallen to the ground, and I have no money, and I have lost everything. And I'm trying to go to meetings. I'm trying to be a mother. And one more time, she, just a kid, she just said something, and I beat her within an inch of her life. The kid got away from me and managed to lock herself in a room, and I found her under a bed. But I knew that I really had to change, because you had begun to fill me up. God had begun, He was trying so hard to get into me. And that's when my life really took off for the better. Because for the next, 7 or 8 years, I made 7 meetings a week. I married this man. We went to meetings 7 days a week. We became so involved in this program, not just activity, but in actions. And I began to sponsor women and go places, do things, take the actions that I'm going to talk about in the morning. And suddenly some things begin to be lifted from me, and I begin to feel a transformation take place in my life that you all will experience if you will work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can guarantee you that. I know it will happen. But the prayer and meditation, I didn't know how to do that. My sponsor had to show me this. Everything, I had to be shown just completely. Everything was brand new to me. I had to learn to ask for help and to take direction. And I did. And I do. This is so important. It is so important. With her, she has standards so much higher than mine, and I have never said no to her, and I mention her all the time. I call her by name because I am so grateful that God put her into my life to give me what she has, and for Clancy, and for Bill, and for every one of you, and for every one of the women that I sponsor. These women are just incredible, because they fill parts of me that I never dreamed could be filled by any anything, but also they helped me so much. This is what it's all about, and I'm talking way, way, way too long, but there's so many things that we can talk about this weekend, and these steps, please, please. The ninth step, I cannot say enough about the ninth step and the experiences that I've had. I have been able to make amends to my parents in a way, a living amends, because my dad is seriously ill. He's dying of Parkinson's disease, and I am the best daughter they could possibly have. And I do it not because I have to, but because I want to. But it had to start somewhere where you just did it, whether you wanted to or not, Marcia. You go there, you call them, you do these things. My older brother and I for years could not sit in the same room together, and the only thing that held us together was his glorious wife. She was an angel from heaven, and she held our family together. You know, this is the kind of life that I had lived with them, but I had to learn to get all over again, to say, be polite to these people, to treat these people like I would. I treated strangers better than them. Terrible things begin to happen after 10 years sober. When I say terrible things, just scary things, painful things for me. But I had a nephew who was one of the few people in my life that I had connected with. He was very ill most of his life, emotionally in a lot of ways. He was gay, and that was another tough thing. You know, some people can't accept that sort of thing, but I'd always loved him so much, unconditionally, and he had loved me back. But we went through 3 years of AIDS with him, and we lost him. He was 26 when he died of AIDS, and that broke my heart. This is my older brother's son, and this wife of my brother, whom I just cherish. There were a few people in my life that I just connected with because they weren't from this world. They were, God had really, I knew there was something special with them, but she was special. And she was a very brave woman, a very courageous woman. And she through diabetes, was crippled. She had amputation. She was blind. She had kidney transplant. But she had a spirit and a style about her that had so much class and dignity. And there's a word I love, is dignity, because I think I've been able to attain some semblance of grace and dignity to come from the gutter to some semblance of this. But she was a beautiful human being, and I loved her very, very much, very, very much. And last New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve, she died of a heart attack. And this was, but I know that she left when she was supposed to go. And she'd done everything that she could do. Because on Christmas Day, without her, my family was able to sit in the same room together. We were able to tell each other we loved each other. We were able to know that healing had happened through the years just by me being sober and by them just staying who they were, which is good, solid, decent human beings. And I looked around and I just remember the feeling of knowing that what all it took to get us there, and she left after she'd done everything that she could do. And she'd stayed with us just long enough. And this year was, the last time I saw you ladies, the time that I fell in love with you was in April at the conference that I came to up here. And my husband had a heart attack. I got a call that he'd had a heart attack. And that's a pretty frightening thing. And you all, I'll never forget it, the love. And that's what just... my heart, I can't begin to tell you how much you touched my heart, because within an hour of your finding that out, you had a card for me, you had your names on it, and you loved me so much just in that short period of time. I wouldn't trade you for anything in this world in those experiences. And in July, my younger brother had a stroke. and there was a little touch and go there. Life kind of goes on. Like I had said, I turned 50 in February, and I began to realize that that top layer, those people and those things that I have always counted on and loved so and thought would always be there, we just kind of, we have to grow, but we grow up. And God helps us grow up, and He takes us through it, and He enables us to get where we're supposed to be. I've left out so many things because time is just flying by, and I know I'm talking too long. And there had been a Bible verse that I had found that had described my life, all of my life until now. And I think it just is a beautiful thing to hear. It says, "What I do," and this is the way it was until I came here and into this program, "What I do not understand, for I do not do what I want, but I do what I hate. And today, everything that I do, when I know that I'm no longer separated from God because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been the bridge, and I work the steps, and I do what I wish, you know, I'm so glad we're going through the steps, because I do truly every step in this book, both books. I'm a big believer in the 12 and 12. Don't ignore that precious book. I know a lot of old-timers who do, and I don't understand that, because it's an extension. And Bill Wilson wrote that book 13 years after the 12, after the big book, and he had been in a major depression when he wrote that book. That was 13 years living sober. The big book was, I believe, inspired from God to him at 3 years. But the 12 and 12 is important. But today my life is full. It's complete. It's complete, meaning it's complete today. Because I don't know if I'm going to wake up in the morning. None of us do. We don't have any guarantee. And I know that better than most people because of the death and the dying that's happened in my family. But I do know that if I've, the measure of my sobriety today is how I've treated you. And when I lay my head down every night, there's an instant thought that comes to me when the lights go out and there's nobody there but me and God. How did I treat these people today? Who did I harm, and who can I make it up to first thing in the morning? I don't have to live that way anymore, and I'm not going to live that way anymore the way I used to be, and I don't have to. And I'm just starting out. I'm 16 years sober, and as far as I'm concerned, it's just the first day of my life. It literally is, and I'm going to learn something this weekend. I know I am. That's going to make things, whatever's coming. My dad's dying, and I'm able to help him, but he's not going to be with me. And that's been a resolution, a reconciliation. That's been a glorious experience. But in closing, I simply want you to think about something. I want to tell you what happened to me. And it's just something, it's a verse that describes what happened to me. Somewhere along the way, as I took the steps of this program through into recovery and continue in, but somewhere, somehow, and it'll happen to you if you simply will just give yourself to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of your understanding. Suddenly, quietly, I realized that from that moment forth, I would no longer pass through this world alone. Like a new sun, this awareness rose within me, freeing me from fear, opening my life. It was the beginning of love and the end of all that came before. And I love you all so much, and I thank you so much for having me here. God bless every one of you.